Good morning, my name is Keegan Rasko, and I'd like to welcome you to Life Downstream. Life Downstream is a radio show where I, a high school student, and Mr. Morgan, my high school English teacher, talk to interesting people from around the area about their life experiences and how those experiences allowed them to learn outside of the classroom. And with that, I'll pass it over to Mr. Morgan to introduce our guest for today.
We're here today with Jimmy Pearson, the director of the Astor Public Library. Jimmy, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we were talking a little bit before the show about your background, and you've filled all of these different roles throughout your life. You know, you were a military medic, you got into working in libraries, you've been a security guard. And before we kind of start picking apart some of those different roles, could you just kind of tell us a little bit about how you went from military medic into libraries? What was that kind of transition like?
So I was in the Army stationed in Germany and made the decision to leave the military service, went back to Texas. At the time, that's where we had a place to go to, and was there like anybody else looking for an answer in life. What are you going to do? And what targeted my then experience as healthcare, ended up working at Texas Children's Hospital in the pediatric intensive care unit as the operations manager. And I can tell you I'm a tough person. I've seen trauma firsthand and in action. I cannot watch children die. I cannot watch them go through some of the things that they do. It takes a special person to do that, and I'm not that person.
As operations manager, did you get to know a lot of the kids that were kind of coming and going? Like you'd
sure,
see them day to day?
Yeah, you'd see them day to day. You would see their families, you'd interact with them or whatever, you'd be there and you're seeing some of the most exposed moments of their life. One of the stories that sticks with me is a young lady that was out swimming in the pool. Mom put her inside the house to go to the restroom. Dad puts her back out thinking mom's there. She drowned in the pool. And that's it. You know, she was in the ICU and I think it was about 11 days and she passed. That was probably the most excruciating thing I've ever dealt with.
Did you ever talk to other staff there about how they wrap their heads around this? I mean, it just sounds so unbearable and so unbelievably tragic. I mean,
so Texas Children's does a really good job of preparing staff for that. Mm-hmm. Not everybody can be in those situations. Not everybody can work in those areas. But they do have, they did have, and I'm sure they still do, training. Mm-hmm. They have counselors if, you know, you needed to reach out for that or whatever. But you're very well briefed in what to expect before you even move into that type of a position. Mm-hmm. The nurses are just amazing.
When you decided, I gotta do something else, this is too much, what was that kind of next step like? I mean, you were looking for jobs. You were just,
I was just looking for jobs, supporting my family. I had a bachelor's degree at the time and a master's degree in public administration. And really, truly, when you grow up in the military, part of it, I mean, it's a wonderful experience. It's a life-changing experience, but you also don't really have to think about who you are. And I think for me, it was like kind of an unfolding. You know, this is who I truly am as an individual. This is what I truly value in life. This is what I really want out of life. And what direction does that go and how does that take me? I had to stop as a security guard after that and actually really love that job because of the first time in my life I was responsible for nothing. Mm-hmm. And I got to spend time with my children. I would put my two older sons on the school bus in the morning, take my youngest son and his cousins to story time at the library. Ended up working for and finding a job, landing a job as a Houston in the Houston Public Library System as a library service specialist is a classification. So that's somebody with a bachelor's degree. You're considered at the paraprofessional level and was at the Park Place Regional Library as an adult library services specialist. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Sit in answering reference questions.
What was the first day on the job like? I mean, was it immediately clear like, this is my new thing?
It was immediately clear. I mean, the minute I walked in the doors, I was at a smaller branch to begin with and then transferred to the larger one during my training. that was back before, you know, I mean, the internet was obviously in place, but Houston Public prepares you for that role by making you walk through the Dewey Decimal System. So you have a notebook, a spiral notebook that's about 4 inches thick. You have to go through and answer questions from print sources.
Whoa.
And then you have to go through and answer like every fifth question using the internet source.
Huh.
You know, to be able to even sit at the reference desk by yourself and alone and kind of get you into that mindset. Yeah, as a library school student, you actually take an entire class on reference work. And what is a reference question and how to drill down to get people, you know, to the information they're actually asking for. So it was immediate. It was absolutely, I knew I had found my calling. Went to library school, ended up becoming a children's librarian at the Houston Public System. I wanted to be a teen librarian, but they didn't have anything available at that time. So for 3 months, I did story time for kids, and my army buddies think that's hilarious. And then took a job at the Harris County System, working in a very rough neighborhood where we had drugs and gangs and murders outside the library walls, and created a safe space for kids and the community to come into.
So you had a couple of different roles at different libraries, and you now, like I said, are the director of the Astor Public Library here. Before we hear a little bit more about what those roles have kind of shown you over the years, I'm dying to know. You mentioned something before we started the show today about some of these really powerful moments that you experienced while you were a military medic. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like when you were in your early 20s and you found yourself staring across the demilitarized zone at North Korea? What was that moment like for you?
So I can tell you the entire tour in Korea changed who I am in my life. At 20 years old, I was responsible for the daily care of 220 men. It was my job to make sure that they were fit for duty, that they were taken care of. When we went to the field, I was with Air Defense Artillery. So Air Defense Artillery sets up over a wide area of expanse, because you'll have, you call it guarding the sky. So we have weapons that are meant to shoot down enemy aircraft. And to do that, you position a platoon maybe here, and then 5 miles in between, there's another one, then five. So to take me anywhere to see somebody that was having an issue was a Jeep ride, and you would be there. We were a helicopter ride away from definitive Western medical care. And I lived that for a year, in 1985 to 1986. Sorry, I'm reaching and grasping for what that was like. So it was a moment where responsibility after that is that everything else is easy after that, if that makes sense. And you gain a confidence in yourself and your abilities. And then part of that process, we went up to the DMZ for a range to fire AK-47s and also a Russian RPG. And if you've ever seen the movie Rambo, the one where he's shooting at the helicopter and it goes bang, I can tell you, compared to Army light anti-tank weapon, that one was easy to fire. I got to fire it. We only had one because I was the medic and I told these guys it's my turn. So it's like really cold on the DMZ, and I did that. But actually, you know, you swear an oath to the Constitution of the United States. And as a young man, you don't understand really what that means. You know, you might be from a military family like I was, and you see the pageantry, you see the uniforms, you see the love of country. And then you stand on the DMZ and you look into North Korea, and you know in that moment what freedom is about. And you know in that moment how powerful it is that we as a country, as Americans, the lifestyle that we lead. It's an amazing realization of how free we truly are.
Can you talk a little bit more about like how the military helped show who you were? Helped show yourself, you know, kind of your own identity.
I mean, so after Korea, I went from the very best unit that I'd ever been assigned to in the 2nd Infantry Division to the very worst unit I've ever been in.
Okay.
And so as a specialist in the Army, which is an E4 rating, I had more authority in that year's time than I had had ever since, until I made the rank of senior NCO. And so it was hard to, one, scale back down to being just another E4 when I spent a year as doc. And my first field problem before I went to that field exercise, I was specialist Pearson. When we came back from that field exercise, I was doc. And in the military, in the Army, that's an honorific title. It means that you take care of them, and they understand it's an acknowledgement. You just don't call somebody doc just because they're in that position. Mm. You know, I carried a Geneva Convention card that I still have to this day, and Keegan, I'll show it to you sometime. I have hair. and that Geneva Convention card said it identified me as a medic, and it's a mindset that I would be the last one released if there was ever a time when I was a prisoner of war, because I was there to take care of the people and the men and women that I would be there with. So it's a different, it's a mentality. So you adopt this. It's easy. It was easy for me. I'm the oldest child out of four. You know, we talk a lot about birth order or whatever. Then I joined the military. You have all this responsibility to include, you can shut down the dining facility if you don't feel that it's clean, if they're not doing their job and they're going to sicken somebody or whatever. So we're trained in rudimentary field, you know, food inspection, sanitary conditions for latrines and where they're sited, water purification. And, you know, a medic in that type of environment kind of is the responsible person for all of that.
What was it like to shoulder that responsibility? I mean, I just, when you mentioned earlier, you know, over 200 men and it's your job to keep everybody healthy, that sounds so intimidating to somebody that knows little about, you know, the medical field. What was it like carrying that? Was it an easy fit? Were you pretty quickly like, okay, I'm the firstborn, I could do this?
Yeah, I think it was a, you know, the initial, like, so when you go to Fort Sam Houston, right, your initial training is, it's all about the patient. It's all about the patient. You can actually fail like an exercise or whatever. And at Fort Sam Houston, you go through this thing where there's simulated gunfire and smoke and helicopters, chaos and everything else. And you're triaging. So you're training you for work on the battlefield. So let you have an incoming or whatever, like come in and you have to lower the patient to the ground. If say you're doing a litter carry and you're not over your patient protecting them, right? It's this whole mindset of service, because we're not allowed to fire as medics offensively. You can fire defensively in defense of your patient. And that's all part of that process or whatever. So then to take that in a year and a half later, go to Korea with it and that kind of mindset, conserve the fighting strength. It's drilled into you from the very day one. And then you have the ability to use that, and it tempers you. You know, you come out of that situation feeling like you have confidence in who you are.
And so in the military, you got to travel into how many foreign countries?
So I have served on three continents, U.S., Europe, and Asia.
So, yeah, and then as you moved through these different foreign countries and you got to see them, like, for example, you never stepped foot into Korea, North Korea.
No, you don't step foot into North Korea.
So I think it's kind of impressive to think about how different your mindset was when you look into a nation that you've never actually stepped foot into. It's kind of, you know, like a monster hiding under the bed, so to speak. And it's kind of, well, not necessarily, maybe that's not the correct analogy, but it's interesting to hear that a foreign country or what happens in a foreign country has the ability to completely change the way you view your own country. So how has your views changed since traveling to these other foreign countries?
So I think that you gain an understanding of, like I said before, how powerful it is that we have the freedom that we do. In Germany, people at that time when I was stationed in Europe, it was part of your in-processing, part of your orientation to the country, that if the Polizei, which is the German police, come into like a nightclub, for say, everybody like stops. They like, if they're ordered to get down, they get down, and then the Polizei will come in and maybe get somebody that they're looking for, whatever, take them out. Everybody gets up and keeps dancing. You know, it would be interesting how that would play out in America. You know, somebody comes in and they're like, get down. We're like, what? Who are you? You know, you're telling me to do that. But it's interesting for the culture, like culturally, how It is. And, you know, the entire thing, like, so let's say the allegiance to the flag, right? Mm-hmm. In North Korea at the time, and I'm sure it's still there, it's called, we call it Propaganda Village or whatever. North Korea has built a city across that you can look into, and they bus people in and have them working, make it look like it's all big and it's prosperous, everybody's happy. They had at that time the largest flag on the largest flagpole that we knew on the planet, right? Yeah. And okay, allegiance to North Korea, allegiance to North Korea, allegiance to North Korea. And I don't want to get overly political with this or anything else, but it really, that we have the freedom that we do to maybe choose what that allegiance looks like for us. It's not being dictated to us. This is how you're going to honor your country. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the, I think, the piece that we don't understand, that there are people that aren't allowed to not honor things,
yeah,
or do it in that manner. Mm. And is that disrespectful then to do it in your own way?
So you told us earlier about how, you know, you've had these different groups that you've worked with at different libraries. At times you've worked with younger kids, then you worked with young adults. What was it about the young adult demographic that you really found compelling and interesting? Why young adults?
I will tell you, and you as a teacher probably know this, man, they will keep you engaged, right? They're energetic. They're excited about pizza. One of my jobs was to make sure the pizza was there for book club or whatever. They'll keep you young. You know, I've talked to a lot of people that are in the young adult world or whatever, and it's just absolutely, you never know what's going to happen. You know, and it's not boring. It's, you know, children's are okay, but children to me are like, you know, a small dog. Like, I'm very careful around small dogs because I don't want to hurt them or anything else. And it's like,
yeah,
you know, even now I've had to do story time a couple times, and it's cool. And I love seeing the kids. I love seeing the babies and stuff. But, you know, a teenager, it's just like, and they're real. Like, their brains are developing. They're firing off. They'll tell you whatever they think and not even think about it, right?
Did you have exchanges over the years with kids that were in that same mindset that you were at, where it's like, I don't know what I want to do, you know, pre-identity almost, you know, kids that haven't yet fully kind of figured out what they want to do? Did you have any powerful conversations with some of those kids, like, hey, you keep going to the library, what's up?
Well,
what's
I mean, your... So if you think about the libraries that I served in doing that or whatever, especially when I was a branch manager in Harris County, you're creating a safe space. You might be the only safe space within the community. You know, you're dealing with gangs, and you're dealing with drugs, or you're dealing with a 17-year-old gang lieutenant who's using middle school kids to funnel the money from the drug sales over into the library every afternoon, you know, until you become aware of that. And then you choose to tell them they're not welcome on the day that your police officer's not there. And then you're told, when you tell the police, so that they know not that he's not allowed in the library, basically trespass, that he carries a 9mm. You know, so you're talking about that type of environment. So powerful conversations, probably not so much because you're a librarian. Mm-hmm. A little bit different for a teacher probably, but you do know immediately that you're making a difference in a kid's life, mm-hmm. right? You know that you're making a difference by just providing them a space to hang out till their kids get there, or their parents get there to pick them up, or it's time for them to go home or whatever.
When you were at that library, did you have kids that were there every single day?
Every day.
That used that space for that reason every single day?
Every day. One of the awakenings for me is I had a kid that I asked him one day, hey, school's getting out. You ready? I don't want to get out of school. Like, you know, and I'm like, oh, you love school. That's great. You know, awesome. Mm. No, not really. Okay, well, you're confusing me. You don't want to see summer come here. You don't really. Your school's okay. What's going on? He would not eat breakfast and lunch because that's where he got his nutrition. That's where he received 2 meals a day. And so summer would mean he'd only have one at home. Mm. You know, you're talking about that kind of poverty. You're talking about that kind of situation or whatever. I really irritated my children's librarian and used every craft money that I got from the friends group that year to buy, or that for our use to decide, instead of spending it on crafts, we had pizza, and I made sure that kid knew when they were going to come in. The year after that, the Aldine School District implemented the feeding the kids during the summer, but that was a turning moment when you really understand that libraries are not just about books. right? They're not. They're so much more in so many communities.
So how have you, what are some of the things that you've done since getting to Astoria to kind of increase the presence of the library on kids' lives, on adults' lives? How have you changed the library since you came into the office?
So I'll tell you, it's a great example to use the 10th Street stage. The concert series ended last night. Brian Bovenizer, you guys know him well here at KMUN, and his group, the New Old Stock, we had about 140 people and children and adults or whatever that are walking through. We close off the street in front of the library, and it's a great place for people to hang out. No beer, no alcohol or whatever, just a family-friendly event. Kids are dancing, drawing with chalk on the road or whatever.
I was going to say, that was one of the more moving things. I was driving here and I saw right outside the library little flowers and things that the kids were drawing on while they were listening to the music.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's absolutely that giving people, and so let's call it a simple moment of pure joy, right? So last night in front of the library, the world got a little bit better for just a moment. Didn't solve all of our problems. We've got some complex issues that we're dealing with at the city. We've got issues we're dealing with on a national level or whatever. But for one moment in time last night, we had a simple moment of pure joy, listening to some great music, eating cookies, watch Luke eat a cookie while he's playing the bass. Like, oh my God, that was too cool, right? That's the kind of experience that I've been working on and creating since I became the director at the Astoria Public Library.
This kind of leads me right into the next question, or the thing I was thinking about as you were talking earlier. When you think about the future of libraries, the future of the Astoria Public Library, is that why you feel like libraries will just kind of forever have a relevance, no matter how dependent people become on their own technology, or, you know, how powerful personal technology becomes? Oh, I could search this on my phone or laptop. Libraries will always be important because of that role. Do you feel like, is that accurate? Like the space they provide.
So for those at home, you can't see this, but I'm smiling because, you know, there was a Library of Alexandria, right? And I'm sure that there is people at that time that said, you're not going to be relevant. You're not going to be needed. Maybe people are going to be able to get their own papyrus out and and do their own books and stuff, right? So this is a time-honored discussion that every decade or whatever that comes along, you know, there's books and then there's the computers and you're not going to need the library or whatever. So I challenge you to come in. We've got people at the computers every day of every moment that we're open, right? There's bookstores right here in the city, right? But not everybody can afford to buy a book. We also break isolation. There are people that have no one and they come to the library and that's their socialization for the day. You know, so it's interesting. If you ever want an insight into this, go to a librarian conference. And then listen to them as they're at a table like, libraries are dying. Libraries are going away. Libraries are morphing. The internet's coming on. What's really happening, I think, is as the more technology advances, the more people want no technology, right? So like we have a program at the library where Ray Montgomery brings in his vintage typewriters and the kids love it. Right? They're typing. It's a kinetic.
It's so tactile. Yeah.
It's a tactile, you know, like experience.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with a computer screen or internet. So libraries are relevant. We're alive. We're functioning. We are becoming and meeting the needs of our communities. We are the heart of the communities that we reside in. We're doing more with less sometimes, depending on budgets and everything else, but we are still here. We're never going away.
I talked to my niece before I came in to do the show today, and she's six. And I said, how are things going? What's up? What have you been doing? And she said, everything's great. I've been playing a lot. I went to the beach, and I've been reading so much. And I'm like, what are you reading? What you know, do you have a favorite book at the house? And she said, well, not really, but I've been going to the library and I can pick books off the shelf and I can just read any book I pick off the shelf in the kids section. She goes to the kids section, but she was so proud of being able to go down this long line of books and pick anyone out and then just try to start reading it. And I thought, you know, her playing with an iPad or her doing any number of other things wouldn't give her that sense of joy and that sense of accomplishment. And they're going, they're in this stage now, and I'm guessing a lot of, you know, kids her age do this, where every 2 weeks or whatever, they go and they pick a whole bunch of random books that I don't even think they're doing a lot of, like, let's read through this first and then let's rent it if you like it. It's just, oh, this cover looks cool, I'll have this for the next 3 weeks, you know?
Right.
It's just so cool. And, you know, well, I think a bookshop can't really give that to you. You right. go to a bookshop and you really are going to think long and hard about, let's read through this book. We're going to spend money on it. Let's really make sure this is the one we want to buy, you know?
And, yeah, but what's cool about libraries is so we can form that path, right? We can form that bridge to the bookstore, right? I mean, I work really well with, you know, Lisa here. And just so you see a book that you like in the library, then you go to the bookstore and you can buy it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's there, but you're creating lasting memories, you're creating, and it's been, studies have been proven that you interact differently, you read, your brain does something different when you're reading pages off of, you know, or letters off of a page, it's responding differently, it's a different mechanism of the synapses firing and everything else. It's creating a different experience.
Looking ahead to the next couple months at the library, is there anything we should kind of be aware of, anything going on in your world that the public should kind of be thinking about as the summer draws to a close here?
So the city council has approved in all three cities, Warrenton, Seaside, and Astoria, that we will share the library catalog. So what does that mean to you? So we do that now. You can come to the library, you can call us and say, hey, Seaside has this book, can you get it for me? The way that process currently works is we write that down, then we go to see if they have it, then we put that on a spreadsheet, we email it to Seaside, they pull it off the shelf, then one of the library directors every week goes to Warrenton, then to Seaside, Seaside to Warrenton, Warrenton to Astoria to bring that book to you. The way it will happen and the way it will work after the 17th of September is you'll be on your screen at home and you'll see the catalog and you hit, I want that book, and you'll hit, I want it, and you'll put a hold on it. You don't care where it's at, and it will be automated. You won't have to call us for that anymore. You can, and Warrenton and Seaside currently do this. And the even better part of that the library directors are really excited about is we've implemented a courier service. So 2 days a week, this courier will go between Warrenton, Seaside, and Astoria to drop items back and forth between the three libraries.
So cool.
What's special about that is as we mature in this process, it means we're acting as three libraries. We are all distinct. We are all individual. We have different, you know, financing levels available. But it means that as a director here in Astoria, I don't have to buy that book if Seaside's already got it.
Yeah.
And I can use that money that I would have spent to buy that book on another book, you know, a different item. And so, well, maybe I can buy two of the most popular New York Times bestsellers versus the one that I buy now, because we're cooperating in the collections. And not everybody has to keep and duplicate the items that are on their shelf. Powerful move. And I'm excited about it. It's taken a lot of work behind the scenes, but it's going to be great for the community.
Cool. Jimmy, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks. So this is the section of the show where I like to offer my student perspective on our guest in the studio today. And the one point that I want to drive home is the power of a single moment. Multiple times, Jimmy mentioned his experience looking across the DMZ into North Korea. He talked about the time a young girl drowned in a pool and he had to help her in his clinic. And Mr. Morgan talked about a time a young girl was talking about picking a book off of a shelf. And I wanted to point out that each one of those moments changed fundamentally the lives of the person who was experiencing it. And it goes to show us that we should never underestimate the power of a single point in time in our lives, because those moments can radically change our futures and the way we view ourselves.